Here and now, coming up, Wither, the once powerful neocons. We'll speak with a neoconservative who says mistakes have been made in Iraq, but still thinks the U.S. needs to play an aggressive role in the region. But first, British ground forces and U.S. military copters fought with gunmen in southern Iraq today, where four American security contractors and their Austrian co-worker were abducted in a convoy hijacking. Iraqi police say the Austrian was later found dead, and one of the Americans was found gravely wounded. Meanwhile, another development is raising sectarian tensions in Iraq. The country's Shiite-led government has issued an arrest warrant for Iraq's leading Sunni Arab cleric, accusing him of inciting terrorism. The move against Harith Dari, head of the Muslim Scholars Association, follows this week's massive kidnapping at the Sunni-led education ministry. Los Angeles Times reporter Louise Rogue is covering the story. She joins us from Baghdad. And at first, Louise, is there a connection between these two events, the arrest warrant and the kidnappings this week?
Well, certainly, if you talk to Sunni politicians here, that's what they would claim. They say, you know, the arrest warrant is really the government's attempt to deflect attention from this ongoing controversy over the mass kidnapping. They say it's a smokescreen.
Well, why would a Sunni cleric carry out a kidnapping at a Sunni-led ministry?
Well, I'm not sure that that is the implication. I think what they're saying is that Shia security forces, or Shias posing as security forces, conducted the kidnapping, and that the government, which is, of course, Shia-led, has been unwilling or unable to find and root out the kidnappers. And so because they are either, you know, in collusion with the kidnappers or simply a weak government, they're now trying to deflect attention and say, oh, well, you know, here, let's concentrate on this guy, the head Sunni cleric, and let's go and get him.
Well, and who is a Sunni cleric? What is he accused of doing?
Harith Dari is accused of inciting violence. Now, Dari is sometimes a sarcastic critic of the government and the U.S.-led coalition. He has been very dismissive of previous calls for reconciliation and has criticized the trial of Saddam Hussein, questioning its legitimacy.
Does he have a huge following?
Unlike the Shia, who there's no doubt that their preeminent cleric is Ali Sistani, you know, the Sunnis are less followers of one man in particular, but he has been a sort of uniting voice for the Sunnis here in Iraq.
Well, and as you well know, there was a huge effort to convince the former majority Sunnis to join the government of the new majority Shias. A lot of negotiations to convince them to even join the government. Is there a fear that they will now leave the government in droves because of this arrest warrant?
Suddenly the Sunnis were already sort of teetering, and a lot of people within the Sunni blocs have called for a walkout even before this arrest warrant was issued. And this has just pushed them closer to the edge. Today, Friday, you know, we had Friday prayers here, and Sunni clerics all over the country condemned the government's move. One Abdul Samari, a cleric here in Baghdad, called Dari a symbol and the warrant a bullet that has now killed whatever is left of reconciliation plans, mercy or forgiveness. Mm. So you're very angry outpouring there.
And this is just the issuing of the warrant. He hasn't been arrested yet?
He hasn't. By all accounts, he's in Jordan at the moment and has dismissed, on regional TV, has dismissed this arrest warrant as politically motivated.
Well, Louise, what do you think is going to happen now? There's plenty of violence from both sides, but reports that Shiite militias in particular have been targeting Sunnis. We hear the body count every day. Bodies turn up on the streets. Do you think this is a turning point for the Iraqi government, or will it blow over, given especially that he's in Jordan?
It's interesting. The country's deputy prime minister, Barham Saleh, who's a Kurd, said he hadn't heard of the arrest warrant. That could indicate some division within the government itself. Maliki has convened the cabinet for a meeting next week to try and bridge these divisions, but the government is already very weak, and a walkout would just be really detrimental, certainly for the violence here, which has worsened over the years.
Louise Rogue, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, speaking with us from Baghdad. Louise, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, with the continuing bad news from Iraq, many of the architects of the war are backing off their original support. In particular, the self-proclaimed neoconservatives, the former liberals, turned conservative by what they perceived as an excess of anti-Americanism in the 60s. Neocons mock the realist approach to foreign policy, calling it Chardonnay diplomacy, meaning institutions like the UN and NATO that often tolerate dictators to keep the peace. Neocons call for an aggressive push for democracy and coin phrases like axis of evil. But with Democrats in control of Congress and the return to center stage of more moderate figures like Robert Gates and James Baker from the first Bush administration, is there room in the new order for neocons? Well, we start today with Joshua Moravchik. He's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He recently wrote an open memo to fellow neoconservatives. It was entitled Operation Comeback, recommending how they should respond to the drubbing they're taking in the wake of the failures in Iraq. And Joshua Moravchik joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm very, very happy to be with you, Robin.
Well, you know, let's get the question right out there. What do you say to people who say you should be taking your lumps? It was at your encouragement and urging, not yours personally, but the neoconservatives, that President Bush took the road to the war in Iraq.
Well, you know, I think that's fair enough. The war has gone very badly. But on the other hand, what I would argue is that the central idea that the neocons had was that the status quo in the Middle East was just not safe for the world. It also wasn't safe for people who live in the Middle East. It was giving rise to progressively more lethal terrorism and much other violence as well, and that the only way to turn that around is to try to change the Middle East. And you know, it is indeed a radical idea, but I still think it's the right idea.
You and others as well, Richard Perle recently spoke to that effect, but some neoconservatives have backed way off. You know, there was a recent dust-up over Vanity Fair excerpt, Richard Perle, David Frum, Kenneth Edelman, characterizing them as appalled at how the Bush White House carried out the war, and in some cases saying, in retrospect, it wasn't a good idea. Others, like Francis Fukuyama, have flat-out said it was a mistake. First of all, how heated is this discussion? I mean, I'm not assuming that you all meet in a hall, but how heated is the conversation among neoconservatives, and why... You know, why isn't Francis Fukuyama right?
First of all, if you read all the stuff written about us, we wouldn't meet in the hall, but in a secret underground cell somewhere. This is serious business, what's going on in Iraq, and there needs to be an open airing of disagreements among ourselves and with others. I think that the thing in Vanity Fair was really not good journalism, in the sense that the author seemed to only interview those neocons who were going to say the things that he wanted to hear. I don't know why he did that, but I'm upset to see colleagues of mine turning on Bush and saying, "Well, you know, we were all right, but Bush screwed it up." You know, if this war in Iraq ends up a complete disaster, I think all of us who supported the policy have to share in the heat for its having proved mistaken.
What do you say to people who say, but there were others who were very critical of an invasion of Iraq? You write, the administration made mistakes, so did we. And they say, how could you have made the mistake of thinking there were weapons of mass destruction, this was going to be a cakewalk, that the U.S. would be welcomed with roses, that it would just take the overthrow of Saddam Hussein for democracy to bloom? Because the list is so long. Scott Ritter, chief U.N. weapons inspector, Mohammed Baradei of the U.N., Jimmy Carter, others were saying the opposite. Should the brakes at least have been put on?
Well, in the run-up to the war in Iraq, when we were arguing for it, a lot of other people were arguing against it. And why didn't we listen to them? Some of them have proved, so it seems to be more prescient than we were. And I think the reason is that we've argued with these same people over other issues in the past, and we've always been right and they've always been wrong. Starting with the Cold War, which was the real big one.
Well, as you know, your critics argue that it wasn't neoconservative ideas that defeated communism, that then-President Reagan drove up defense spending to threaten the Soviet Union for naught, that the Soviet Union collapsed under its own weight. But I want to put that argument aside for now and ask you, what happens now? Do you worry, as we've heard others worry, that the failure in Iraq is going to set back your cause in regarding countries that might pose much more of a threat than Iraq ever did?
Absolutely. You know, I would insist that we still can't judge the dimensions of this failure, but clearly that the failure that we're having is going to weaken our hand in trying to stop Iran from acquiring a nuclear bomb, and of course, it's weakening the influence of us neocons here at home. It's hurting.
Well, and you say that there was another reality check. This idea of imposing democracy can have surprises, as we saw in the elections in the Palestinian territories and Egypt, when parties unappealing to neoconservatives have done well. This is one of the things that you feel that, if I'm reading you correctly, neoconservatives have to take a good, long, hard look at.
No. Oh. I mean, yes, we should take a good, hard, long, hard look at everything. But in almost every country in the region, there's been some widening of the political space. That is, space for dissent, space for opposition, space for push for changes over these last couple of years. And that does trace back to U.S. pressure in that direction. It is true that as there has been this widening space, some of the people who have taken best advantage of it are people we don't like, that is, Islamists. But on the other hand, in the long run, there may be no way to defeat Islamism without democracy.
Joshua, I tell you what, we'd like to have you back to talk about where neoconservatives go from here. In the interest of time, I don't think we can cover it all now. But give us, you know, one overarching idea. What do you think is the most important thing, policy-wise, that can happen, at least from the neoconservative point of view?
Well, I don't know if it's going to help get neoconservatives back on top, but I think the most important thing the U.S. government has to do in the next year is to bomb Iran. Everything that we've tried to do in the war on terror will be negated, neutralized. Even if things come out not so bad in Iraq in the end, that will be negated and neutralized. If President Bush leaves office with this wild man, President Ahmadinejad's finger on the nuclear trigger.
This, as James Baker and the Iraq Study Group and others, a list of others, are urging the Bush White House to, in fact, talk to both Iran and Syria.
Well, I was laughing at your intro, Robin, to myself, and not at you, but just at the funny juxtaposition where you said that critics call their approach Chardonnay diplomacy. The idea that we can sit down with Iran and that they will want to pull our chestnuts out of the fire in Iraq is just harebrained.
Joshua Muravchik, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Joshua, thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome. Glad to be with you, Robin.
So, no backing down. When we come back, the neocon big picture on Here and Now. And now, and we've been taking a look at the political neoconservative movement. Former liberals turned fierce backers of the idea that the U.S. should impose democracy, first during the Cold War and today in the Middle East. We just spoke with neoconservative Joshua Muravchik, who says neocons should take some heat for mistakes made in Iraq, but on the other hand, should also stick to their ideological guns. We turn now to Gideon Rose, managing editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. Gideon, you just heard it. Despite failures in Iraq, Joshua Muravchik, again of the American Enterprise Institute, saying the U.S. should now bomb Iran.
Well, I think that Josh has demonstrated a couple of points about neoconservatism. One is what most people take to be its substance, which is its stress on ideas, democracy promotion, and the like. But the other, and I think it's as important, if not more important, is its temperament. In fact, one of the great features about the American foreign policy debate is there's a gut understanding among most of the players, or at least an assumption among most of the players, that good things tend to go together, that capitalist economics tends to go with democratic politics, which tends to go with Pacific international behavior and so forth. So from the founding onward, many people throughout the American foreign policy apparatus and diplomacy have believed it to be the United States' mission to try to create a world beyond its borders that resembles the United States and its domestic institutions. And I don't think the neocons are unique in that. What they are unique in is the aggressiveness and style with which they go about trying to implement that kind of goal. And here I think the answer, the difference, is really one of temperament, which is that the realists tend to be down-to-earth, conservative with a small c, and pragmatic, and the neocons tend to be visionary, radical, and very stubborn in their objectives.
Well, unwilling to compromise, for instance, in the run-up to the war, there were those who were cautioning that, in fact, Saddam Hussein might be the only thing holding these three disparate worlds, the Kurds, the Sunnis, and the Shias, together. The voice from the other side, from the neoconservative side, was full speed ahead, democracy will free them.
Exactly. What the chief feature, in fact, I think, in practice of the neocons is their conviction that a visionary, different future is not just possible, but almost relatively easy to bring about if one only musters the will to do so. Neocons, like all idealists, have an ability to imagine a world dramatically different from the one that exists now. In some ways, the cardinal failing of the realists is they see present reality so vividly, and they see the constraints on action, that they find it very hard to imagine things being different, and they don't, therefore, try to place bets on the future being different. Neocons, like other idealists, are the opposite of that. They see a world aborning. They can imagine and project out a world that is different from the one we're in now. And that's exactly what happened in Iraq. It wasn't so much that you wanted to see an Iraq different from Saddam Hussein, because everyone wanted that. That was the Clinton administration's policy. That was Colin Powell's policy. The question was, could you actually bring this about, and how? And the neocon contribution to this debate was the notion that all you had to do was topple Saddam and things would work.
But I want to rush to say that to give Joshua Moravcik credit, he does write, it would be pigheaded given what's happened in Iraq, given that President Bush's popularity has plummeted. It would be pigheaded not to reflect and rethink, which he does to some extent in the article. But he also seemed to really resist the notion that the neoconservatives had that much to do with policy. Your thoughts?
I don't think the neoconservatives by themselves could have gotten a country into war with Iraq. What was shocking to me, and I think which was a neocon hallmark, was not just the brusquerie of the style with which we went to war, abandoning allies, snubbing everybody's nose in it, but also the recklessness in terms of the lack of planning. Well, the Defense Department essentially demanded and received complete control over the post-war planning operation and then proceeded to do basically nothing, believing that if you just turn things over to Ahmad Shalabi and his minions, everything would be fine. And that really, I believe, still remains the key source of the problems. It was the first several months in which the administration found itself in occupation of Iraq and didn't know what to do, that things were problematic. And I think there, the neocons, because the Defense Department under Feith and Wolfowitz really did have complete and total control under the supervision probably of the Vice President's office, that they screwed things up. And so I think that that's their great failure, and they are deservedly taking the blame for that and will continue to do so.
Well, do you want to ask, are there neoconservative advisors in the halls of the White House today, or are they completely gone?
Well, no, the Vice President's office is still stocked with them, and there are still a couple here and there in DOD, and there are still maybe even some on the NSC here and there. I think they've lost power primarily, and I think the key players here really are the President and the Vice President, now that Rumsfeld is gone. There's absolutely zero evidence that the Vice President feels he has anything to apologize for or has learned any lessons from Iraq. The President, it's very hard to say what exactly he thinks, although I doubt he feels he's made major mistakes as well. So the real question will be, has especially the drubbing that occurred in the recent elections, but in general the obvious failure to progress successfully in Iraq, has that created a climate in which, despite the two people at the top, the administration finds itself drawn towards a more realist or pragmatic foreign policy. I think that can be overdone. I don't buy the idea that James Baker and Bob Gates and the old Bush 41 crowd are going to come in to dominate the new last couple of years of the administration. But there's certainly a falling out with the neocons, and they are not guiding things. So while Josh Muravchik might want there to be an attack on Iran, I would not expect that myself, not because some people wouldn't be advocating it, but because I doubt that in the administration's internal calculations, those people will actually get the final word.
Gideon Rose is Managing Editor of Foreign Affairs. Gideon, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And here's a quick news note for you from the Netherlands. The Dutch government said today it plans to draw up legislation that will ban full-length veils, known as burkas. In a statement, the Dutch immigration minister said clothing that covers the face when it is worn in public is a security risk. In the past, a majority of the Dutch parliament has said it would approve a ban on burkas, which are worn by some Muslim women. But polls taken in advance of next week's national election suggest the voters have shifted to the left. Well, still to come, a mother eulogizes her son who forgave the kids who shot and paralyzed him. She also challenges parents to do more to prevent violence. That's ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now.
And now. A 23-year-old young man who inspired Philadelphians by rising above gun violence is being remembered this week. 3 years ago, Kevin Johnson was shot in the neck by some teens on a trolley when he refused to give up his Allen Iverson basketball jersey. An athlete, Kevin was left a quadriplegic, dependent on a ventilator and his mother's round-the-clock care. He forgave his attackers, even befriending one, and encouraged his mother to do the same. Then both began speaking out against the violence that is a growing problem. This year, over 1,700 people in Philadelphia have been shot, compared to 1,500 last year. Well, Kevin Johnson died early Tuesday morning after his ventilator failed. He'll be buried next week. His mother, Janice Jackson Burke, joins us on the line from their home in the Frankfurt section of Philadelphia. And Janice, first of all, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And our condolences. To have, you know, struggled for the last 3 years and then this. What are your thoughts about the life of your son?
The last 3 years of Kevin's life, God had a purpose for him. I believe that his purpose was to heal, because we needed a lot of healing in my family. And I believe also that Kevin was here to help get a hold on this violence that's going on in Philadelphia. People listened. People stopped and listened when they seen his face on TV. People heard.
He broke through.
Yes.
You mentioned that your son, oddly, helped, in addition to healing other people, healed your family. And I know your mother died of a drug overdose. Your father died of AIDS. You must have felt you were doing everything right, and then this to happen.
Exactly.
But how did his being shot, others would think that wouldn't heal, that would tear apart. How did your son, how was he so forgiving at first? Because you weren't. I mean, even with all your faith.
I was angry. I'm going to be real. Hmm. I was trying to get the money together to bail at least one out of jail, because I was hurting. I forgot completely about my faith for a few months. And Kevin seen, laying in that bed, how angry I was. And he just kept saying, "Mom, please, please. Just don't, Mom. Just forget it, Mom. Just go home."
How you say you wanted to bail out your son's shooters to do something to them yourself? So how did he convince you, you know, to come over to where he was, and how did he get there? I mean, how was he so forgiving?
Because that's just how Kevin was. Kevin was a kind, giving, faithful person. He just was just like that, and for him to be so young, he was just so wise.
He actually became friends with one of the kids involved in the shooting. That young man, who was 18 at the time, went to prison and then was living in a halfway house. Did Kevin have an impact on the young boy who...
Yeah, he had a strong impact on everyone that had seen him. I could be putting Kevin in the van to go to church. People would beep their horns and say, and God bless. And it's this 13-year-old girl that Kevin has never met in his life and got hold of my number and called me and begged me to let her speak at his funeral. And I asked her why, and she explained to me in short why, because she changed her life when she read Kevin's story of forgiveness. And so she is going to speak at her funeral. Never met her a day in my life. Kevin never met her, but Kevin had such an impact on her life that I think that people should hear it.
What do you think, Janice, of Raymond Ferguson? He is the then 15-year-old who actually shot your son in prison. We are reading in reports that he had a really hard life. His parents died of AIDS. A sister is brain damaged after being born with HIV. His half-brother was murdered. He pled guilty but said that that doesn't mean he did it.
Mm-hmm. He's still in denial, obviously. He had a lot of anger in him, and that's why my son, he was going to college. He was in college online, University of Phoenix, to help people just like that.
You've said that people like Raymond Ferguson, again, who shot your son, don't have an excuse, that he needs to take responsibility and stop blaming society. You know, some have compared that to the Bill Cosby.
Yes.
Tell me more about that.
Just like Bill Cosby put it, black people, black women, black men need to take responsibilities for themselves, for their own actions. And if you are out here robbing people to do drugs, now he's going to go and blame society. That doesn't go right with me. Build yourself up. And I knew that I wasn't going to raise my kids the way I was raised.
And despite your best efforts, you know, you've lost a son. And it would feel, I'm wondering if as a mom in Philadelphia, inner city Philadelphia, you also might feel like you're losing the battle. I mean, you know, outside of people taking responsibility, what else do you think has to happen?
Know where your kids are at. Know who your kids are hanging with. No, it's not okay to go spend a night over this boy's house that lives four blocks away that you go to school with every day. You don't know his parents.
Janice Jackson Burke, you understand you've donated your son's organs.
Yes.
So he can live on in that way. What do you think his legacy will be?
For forgiveness and going on, even with the toughest health issues or the toughest when you're angry, just forgive and to go on, live. You can get up and try again. And sometimes you can't get up and try again. Kevin couldn't just stand up and try again. But his mind got up and kept trying and doing. And he still had love in his heart. You will not heal if you don't have forgiveness and love in your heart.
Janice, there's a little girl here in Boston who has astonished everyone with the same attitude. Do you know her at all? She's a little girl, maybe 8 or 9. She was shot and paralyzed, too.
Was she?
Yeah. No. We may hook you up. We should hook you up with her.
Does she have a van?
I don't know. We'll find out.
Because I have a van, a nice van out here, with a corrosion van that has a ramp and everything, TV. It's really nice. It was given to me from a mother that lost her son. So if she needs a van, you know, let her know. Let her mother know.
Well, Janice, you impress us enormously, and we'll see what we can do about the little girl in Boston. Janice Jackson Burke, her son Kevin died this week at 23. 3 years ago, he was shot and left a quadriplegic after refusing to give up his basketball jersey to some kids on a trolley in Philadelphia. He will be buried day before Thanksgiving?
Yes.
Yeah. Janice, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And this footnote, remember we said that Kevin Johnson was wearing Allen Iverson's jersey when Kevin was shot? Well, Philadelphia 76ers basketball star Allen Iverson will be paying for Kevin's funeral. You're listening to Here and Now. Thank you. Well, you may have seen them in your community, mostly young men dashing around like extreme pedestrians. They are practicing parkour. It's from the French word meaning course, and it's all about getting somewhere fast by running, climbing, but don't call it a sport. Parkour disciples say it's more of a philosophy. For Descartes, he was I think, therefore I am. And as Here and Now's Kevin Donovan finds out, in parkour, it's I move, therefore I am.
It takes going out, standing at one point, looking off in the distance, picking another point and saying, I'm going to go there. I'm going to go there fast and efficiently and nothing's going to stop me.
Chris Levesque is describing the core belief of a tracer. That's someone who practices parkour. And when Chris says nothing's going to stop him, he means it. I've seen him bound over 9-foot concrete walls with what looks like the ease of someone getting out of bed. He can balance on a handrail, then jump to another handrail and stick a landing like Spider-Man.
Oh, wow. So that's a spring from...
Oh, that's nice.
From one point, and then you're gripping, like, locking onto the wall.
In America, we call that a cat leap.
Chris is the 25-year-old founder of New England Parkour. It's a local chapter of the international scene with about 200 members. It's huge in France, but parkour is just catching on in the U.S. Most people find out about it through the internet. Today, I'm with Chris and fellow tracer Eric Moore on the campus of Northeastern University in Boston. We're in a plaza looking up at a short flight of stairs.
A single leap to clear all those steps?
Yeah, you run, you know, and you... getting the run up is so key because you don't have a lot of room to
it's
do
like
it.
Like 8 steps.
Yeah, you just have a few steps to get it right. But if you get it right...
Because they're wide
small,
steps.
They're wide.
It's a very long distance, and it's tall at the same time, so it's pretty hard, but... Feels nice.
It's a good one.
It seems impossible, but Chris takes a short running jump and reaches the top step, about 12 feet away. Still, he isn't satisfied.
Actually, the fastest way to do it would probably be to use one of those steps in between, because if you go all the way to the top, your momentum is killed.
That's the funny thing about parkour. This is not for show. These guys are serious about moving efficiently. No flips, no unnecessary bravado. The moves they do are amazing, but they're studied, making a tracer more of a craftsman than an artist. I asked Chris about that. He references parkour's founder, Frenchman David Bell.
What if I have a family member in distress on the other side of this obstacle? Am I going to stay here with my fear? Or am I going to go and make this and do it? So that's one of the ways you can inspire yourself to get over mental blocks.
That sort of discipline stems from parkour's origins in Vietnam. French soldiers use these sorts of moves to navigate the jungle terrain. So I asked Chris, has he ever used parkour outside of practice?
Only a few times, but it has come in handy. Just knowing my body and knowing, you know, how to, like, fall and land so I don't hurt myself. But, you know, I've never been in a chase or something where it's like the movies. But if I get in that situation, I'll be ready.
Very ready, right?
Yeah, I hope so.
After a few hours of watching these tracers, I've caught the parkour bug myself and ask if I can try a move or two. Chris sizes me up and starts me out with an exercise he considers pretty easy. It's called a precision jump, a standing leap from one concrete ledge to another.
For me, this is a small precision jump. It's 5.5 feet across to another ledge that's maybe a half a foot or a foot higher.
Okay, so you're jumping from one ledge to a higher ledge 5 feet in front of you.
So now I get on the ledge, and Chris is coaching me through it.
Now, I want you to commit fully to this.
Yep. All right.
If you don't go all the way, then you could, you know, land with your foot like this and hurt your ankle.
All right, here I go. Oh. I wasn't committed. I wasn't committed.
That's right.
I had a mental block.
It's a lot harder than it looks.
All right.
If you want to try it from the other way,
round two,
from high to low.
It's a little bit easier the other way.
I mean, we don't want to push you past your boundaries here.
This is going to be good.
We know you can do it, though. Nice!
Yeah, there you go.
Nice.
There you go. That was tough.
So now you see. You see how much power that took to do?
Yeah.
And the next time you use the same movement and you get comfortable with it and you add more power and you can get further on the ledge and, you know, maybe eventually you can jump over it.
You can jump over the ledge?
Well, I can't. Maybe. You know, I'm just saying. It's.
We're being helpful.
It's not impossible. It's not impossible.
Here now, producer Kevin Donovan. If you've caught the parkour bug and want to see the tracers in action, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us more ahead, Here and Now.
Yeah.
It's Here and Now.
Baker's Hotline, this is Mary Jane.
Since 1994, Bakers in a Pinch have been calling the Bakers Hotline at King Arthur Flour. The 200-year-old employee-owned company fields about 60,000 calls and emails a year. As we head into the Thanksgiving season, we're going to be spending some time in the kitchen on Here and Now. So today, we start with some baking basics. Joining us from King Arthur Flour in Norwich, Vermont, is Robin Sargent, who helped launch the Bakers Hotline. Robin, I imagine the phones are ringing off the hook this week.
Oh, definitely, yes.
What are the kinds of calls you get?
Well, we frequently, and especially now, I think more and more people are aware of the benefits of whole grains and eating healthy. So we're getting a lot of questions now. How can I substitute whole wheat for all-purpose flour in a recipe?
How would you answer that?
In general, you can really usually do an equal substitution. You can use whole wheat for all-purpose one-for-one if you really want to go grainy. You will find, however, that your doughs and your batters are thirstier because whole grain flour tends to absorb more liquids. Mm-hmm. So you usually have to adapt by adding a little bit more liquid, whether that be milk or water, whatever you're using for liquid. I recommend instead doing more like a 50%.
Well, we have a few of the other emails that have been sent to the Baker's Hotline recently. Here are some of the questions. Your flour says it has no bromates. What are bromates?
Right. Actually, potassium bromate is an additive that was more commonly added in the past. Nowadays, we don't see it so much. But it's a chemical additive that artificially strengthens the flour so it performs better in baking. And you really don't have to add that chemical. We've never added that chemical here at King Arthur Flour. But the chemical was found to cause cancer in laboratory mice. So there are now labeling laws against its use.
Huh.
Again, it just sort of artificially strengthened flour so it performed better, something that flour will do well if you just age it naturally.
Well, in fact, speaking of using flour, what is your best recommendation for, you know, let's just say, rolling out a crust? Do you recommend balling it up and putting it in the fridge prior?
Well, the balling thing is really common. A lot of people will take their dough and they'll make a ball with it. And you know what happens when you do that is it's really hard to roll it out once it's chilled because the center of this ball is still kind of warm and the outside is very cold. Mm-hmm. So as soon as you set it down and put your pin on top of it, it cleaves into two pieces. So it's smarter to shape it into a ball and then press it down into a disc and then wrap it in plastic. And then it rolls out really well.
And do put it in the fridge, though, once you've done that.
Definitely.
And chill
yep.
it. Okay.
All you right. want to keep it cold for about 15 to 30 minutes or so at least.
So that explains all my cleaved balls of dough. Okay, a couple other questions that you've gotten. Which cake pan will last forever? And I am curious, what do you recommend? Do you recommend glass or the old-fashioned kind of tinny one?
You know, I really am a fan of a high-grade aluminum pan for baking, and that's what I tend to use now. And I've had them for years. And these are shinier than they are dark. A lot of the new pans are anodized and they're dark. I find that my cakes tend to get dark too quickly in those pans because the heat is attracted to that dark color and it holds the heat. The shiny pans reflect the heat away, so you get a much more even color on your cake, which is nice.
Well, it's funny you mentioned anodized pans, and I understand you have a degree in science and are very attuned to how much science there is in baking.
I think it's fascinating. I really do. When you're baking bread and the recipe calls for salt, a lot of people don't realize that salt isn't just in there for flavor, although that's a pretty critical reason to add salt to bread. Have you ever had that salt-free bread? Yuck. Mm. I know they make it in Tuscany. They don't add salt, but think about what they're putting on it, right? Parmigiano, Reggiano. And
right, because otherwise it's kind of cardboardy or something.
Yeah, yeah, real flat tasting. But aside from just flavoring bread, salt actually tightens the gluten, which is something that's in wheat flour that creates kind of a stretchy network that traps the carbon dioxide that the yeast is making. So without it, you would have a much looser dough. And on top of that, it helps control fermentation. Without salt, the yeast tends to produce a lot of carbon dioxide, and it kind of gets out of control. And then pretty soon your bread can start to look like a chef's hat on the top. It starts to rise up and then collapse a little bit. So the salt prevents that. So it's an important ingredient for scientific reasons as well as flavor.
Staying on the topic of yeast, you had a cri for help from Japan. What was that?
Oh, that was really one of the funniest questions I ever fielded on the hotline. a woman called. She had been in the country, and she had purchased some products from us, and she called because she was having a problem with her dough. She was making bread, and the bread dough was in a bowl. She had it in her oven with just the oven light on, which is a great place to keep your dough safe and warm without cooking it. But the dough was starting to ooze out of the sides of the oven, and it was dripping down onto the floor, and it was a colossal mess. And she was a little upset, and she was trying to figure out what was going on. And we talked about the recipe, and everything seemed fine. And then we talked about the yeast, and I asked her how much she had used, and she used a package, she said. Well, she bought her package of yeast from us, and we sell it in one-pound packages. So she had put a pound of yeast into her dough.
As opposed to a couple tablespoons.
Or two teaspoons
or whatever, right? Oh, my goodness. Well, that's fun. Some are, you know, actually quite poignant, though. I'm thinking of one we have here. You got a letter from Mary asking if you had an idea for a cake that would keep for greater than a week because her husband is in Iraq. And it takes about a week to get things to him. And she added, he doesn't eat nuts.
Isn't that sweet?
Yeah, what did you recommend?
Well, we recommend most cakes have a pretty good shelf life, but you want something that will probably be enhanced by time. And I think a gingerbread or a pound cake, anything very rich in butter and sugar, is going to keep pretty well on its way overseas, maybe even improve with age. Certainly fruitcake does, right?
If you ever eat it.
He doesn't like nuts, so I don't think that her husband would want fruitcake.
Well, you also heard from an elderly gentleman who lost his wife, and she had made bread for him every day, and he wanted to make it now, too, you know, to carry on the tradition. And you talked him through some of that.
He was a very sweet man. He was in his 90s, and his wife had died, unfortunately. And she made him this bread every day of their married life. And they would have toast for breakfast and then a slice of bread or sandwiches for lunch. And then with dinner, their soup or stew, they'd have the rest of the loaf. And then she would start the bread that night, make a sponge, and then bake it off in the morning for breakfast. And after she died, he missed her so much, and he knew he couldn't bring her back, but he was bound and determined that he was going to eat that bread again. So he had never baked in his life, and he watched her a little bit, but we talked, and I think I got him going, and he said, well, I'm going to go out, and I'm going to buy everything I need, and tomorrow I'm going to call you, and you're going to help me through this. I said, absolutely, I'll be there for you. So the next day, my phone rang, and he called, and he said he had been out, and he had bought everything he needed in the recipe, but there was one ingredient he couldn't find. And he said, where do you buy scalded milk? And I just loved that. I'm picturing in the supermarket half and half heavy cream buttermilk scalded milk.
Well, when baking is about more than, you know, just bread or pies, obviously, there's so much more behind it. Robin Sargent of King Arthur Flour, if you have a baking question, by the way, you can go to our website, here-now.org. We'll link to hers. And we just want to say, in the interest of full disclosure, we requested an interview with you. The fact that King Arthur then sent us a platter of sticky buns has nothing to do with our conversation today.
Well, you know, the easiest way into your heart is through the stomach, right?
Definitely, in this case. Robin, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm baking a biscuit. He's wheeling through his skin while I'm cooking breakfast for the one I love.
We hope these tips help you gear up for the big baking season ahead. Remember, warm ovens come from warm hearts.
While I'm cooking breakfast for the one I love.
Yeah, but how do you turn it on? Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
The heck likes hot milk, sprinkled meatloaf, to show that he's graceful.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.